We're going to talk about a lady, and we're going to introduce her through our book that I just gave you that had, she had a tremendous amount of faith, she and her whole family. That lady's name, as you see on the picture, on the book, front of the book, Corrie ten Boom. Corrie ten Boom was born, hand me one of those please, because I always forget when she was born. Corrie ten Boom, as you can see on our schedule here, she was born in 1892. Whew. And she died in 1983. She was 91 years old. And from the day that I guess she was born, because her family was a very, very religious family, it doesn't say in the book, Call the Hiding Place, what denomination or anything she was. And my guess is, just from reading the book, is that it was sort of undenominational. But the point is, they believed in Jesus as the Savior and that he was God's son. They always participated in Bible study in their home. They always welcomed people. They were from Holland. And in verse 12 of Hebrews, I'm sorry, chapter 12, verse 1, this to me says, depicts what I look at Corrie ten Boom as. I'm sorry. Okay. Since we have such a huge crowd of men of faith watching us from the grandstands, let us strip off anything that slows us down or holds us back, and especially those sins that wrap themselves so tight around our feet and trip us up. And let us run with patience the particular race that God has set for us. Corrie ten Boom was one of those that definitely ran the race that God set for her. She did have hate in her life once in a while. If I was in a prison camp, I would have hate in my life once in a while too. So we're going to talk a little bit about the book, and I did a bad thing. I told you I'd have one of those senior moments again. I have a different book. And I was going to point out certain pages. Well, you know what Roseanne told me? They don't match. So we'll just wing it. But I'm not going to read the whole book to you. You can read. But I'm just going to go through a little things that I thought was interesting, and some of the even had a little humor in it. But like I said, Corrie ten Boom and her family were from Holland. They were not Jews, but this was during the time of the Holocaust. The first little thing that I want to point out to you is her father could never have a house without children. And whenever he heard of a child in need of a home, a new face would appear at the table. Isn't that wonderful that they had that type of family? And I'll tell you something else type of family they had. There were, let's see, two sisters. Corrie ten Boom had two sisters, a brother, and then her father. And they had three aunts living with them. Today, we don't do that very often, do we? Have that many people in one household. But they got along well with each other, and they did great with each other. So the shadow fell across us that winter afternoon in 1937. Now the book opens up with them celebrating. Corrie ten Boom's father was a watchmaker. And later on, Corrie ten Boom became the only female watchmaker and repairer in Holland or in Europe. So that was quite an accomplishment for her. She was sort of tomboyish. Her sister Betsy was, always wearing the perfect dresses that at that time called for. Corrie ten Boom said, my stockings were always around my ankles. And, you know, my dresses were always lopsided. She was very tomboyish. But her sister Betsy was different. Nobody dreamed that this tiny cloud would grow until it blocked out the sky. And nobody dreamed that in this darkness, each of us would be called to play a role. Father, Betsy, Wilhelm, her brother, and Mr. Kahn. Their place that they lived was called, now I may not pronounce this correctly because I don't speak Dutch, Beje, B-E-J-E, is that Beje, Beje? Beje, that was the place where they lived. Now Corrie ten Boom, her father, since her father was a clockmaker, he was very precise in the clocks that he had in his shop, that they were definitely strictly on time. So he made a trip every week, once a week, to a certain place to get the right time, and he would ride the train, and then he'd come back. Well, when Corrie wasn't in school, she loved to go with her father. And I thought this was just really neat. She heard somebody talking about sex one day, and she was about 5 or 6 years old. So the line had stuck in my head, sex. I was pretty sure meant whether you were a boy or a girl. And sin made Tanty James very angry. But what the two together meant, I could not imagine. So, seated next to Father in the train compartment, I suddenly asked, Father, what is sex sin? Can you imagine? Okay. He turned to look at me, as he always did when answering a question, but to my surprise, he said nothing. At last, he stood up, lifted his traveling case from the rack over our heads, and set it on the floor. Will you carry this off the train, Corrie? He said. I stood and tugged at it. It was crammed with the watches and spare parts he had purchased that morning. It's too heavy, I said. Yes, he said. And it would be a pretty poor father who would ask his little girl to carry such a load. It's the same way, Corrie, with knowledge. Some knowledge is too heavy for children. When you are older and stronger, you can bear it. For now, you must trust me to carry it for you. Isn't that wonderful? I love that. There were some other incidences in there, and they were always looking out for their neighbors. And one night, a baby had died. The night before, whatever was going on, they had adopted some children and all like that. A baby had died. And with a basket of her own fresh bread, Mama was making the prescribed call on the family. Now, her mother was very ill. She finally died from cancer. But her mother, to her dying day, took care of all the neighbors, the family that had the dying baby, everything that went on. They were talking about other things that were going on, and her father said, our wise Father in heaven knows when we're going to need things too. Don't run out ahead of him. That was Corrie's. Corrie sort of did that all the time. Don't we do that sometime too? I know I do. You know, let me have it today, Lord. When the time comes that some of us will have to die, you will look into your heart and find the strength you need just in time. Now, I'm going to skip over in my book. And I'm going to, let's see, when the war started in Holland, I thought I had that marked, I'm sorry. Anyway, Corrie ten Boom was in bed. She had the flu, and someone kept pounding on her door. So she went to open the door, and there were the soldiers. And they were asking her a lot of questions about something that had happened. They kept finding all these people that they couldn't locate. Or I'm sorry, that didn't make sense, did it? They were looking for people that they couldn't locate, okay? Corrie ten Boom and her family had a wall, an invisible type wall built in their house. It was invisible to the soldiers, wasn't invisible to them. They conducted, like we do fire, things at school, what do you call them, fire drills. They conducted drills, you know, so that the people in a split moment could go and hide behind the wall. It was made out of brick, not wood, because the person that made it said, oh no, if they knock on the wood, they will know that there's a hiding place back there. So they hid quite a few people. That's where we get the name, the hiding place. Corrie ten Boom and her family hid the Jews. They were not Jewish, but because they hid the Jews, they were taken off to the concentration camp. I may be already getting ahead of myself. Okay. Like I said, I'm not going through the whole book. I just want to point out some things for you. When the soldiers came and said they had to darken all their windows, and there had a lot of other things. I don't know if any of you, I know some of you are as old as I am, but not many of you. And I can remember where we had butter. We couldn't get real butter unless you lived on a farm. Coffee was, you couldn't get coffee. We had to take our bacon ration. Yeah, that's the word I was looking for. We had to take our bacon down to the grocery store because they used that somehow in the war or something. I don't know. But anyway, they had lots of things too that they had to go through because, you know, it was the war. And one of the things that Corrie says, newspapers that no longer carried news, they really were in a bind because they couldn't read about the news. Long, glowing reports of the success of the German army on its various fronts. Those were things that it was hard to adjust to, that they couldn't get newspapers, that they couldn't know what was going on. So we depended again on the radio. Now this is where I think it's sort of cute. Early in the occupation. But they were only allowed to have, let's see, let me see what it says now. I've read this so many times I get confused with what I'm reading. Okay, Peter was going to suggest something about the radio. He was 16 at the time of the invasion and shared with other Dutch teeners the restless energy of anger and unwell-being. Peter installed the table radio behind a curve in the stairs just above Father's room and expertly replaced the old boards while I carried the smaller one down to the big room in their watch store. The army clerk looked at me across the counter. Is this the only radio you have? Well, Corrie says. He consulted a list in front of him. Ten Boom, Casper, Ten Boom, Elizabeth, that's the same address. Do either of them own a radio? I had known from childhood that the earth opened and the heavens rained fire upon liars. But I met his gaze and I said, no. The only time I know in this whole book that Corrie ten Boom lied. That is, to me, that's just amazing. But she did it to save her family, sort of. The true horror of occupation came over us only slowly. During the first year of German rule, there were only minor attacks on Jews in Holland. They took daily walks, and they saw signs that said, Jews will not be served, no Jews allowed. So now we're getting to the nitty-gritty of things. They hid many people. At one time, let's see. I'm trying to coordinate it here. Corrie ten Boom said, the political views of all the people that were around, but, and here I felt a strange leaping of my heart, God did. My job was simply to follow his leading one step at a time, holding every decision up to him in prayer. I knew I was not clever, or sophisticated. If the Benji was becoming a meeting place for need and supply, it was through some strategy far higher than mine. There was a man called Mr. Schmidt. Every man that came in besides the family was called Mr. Schmidt. I thought that was pretty clever. Every man, every woman. And he did a lot of good things for them. And one of the things that they did for the people, the Jews and all, they had ration cards. They had to have certain ration cards before. So this Mr. Schmidt worked somewhere so he could get ration cards. So he would go and get hundreds of ration cards at a time and give them to Corey, and she would give them out to the people that they were hiding. One time, this lady brought this baby and wanted this preacher to take care of this baby. This baby was a Jewish baby. And they wanted it hidden, and they wanted it to be taken care of. And the preacher said, no, definitely not. We could lose our lives for that Jewish child. Unseen by either of us, Father had appeared in the doorway. Give the child to me, Corey, he said. Father held the baby close, his white beard brushing its cheek, looking into the little face with eyes as blue and innocent as the baby's own. At last he looked up at the pastor. You say we could lose our lives for this child? I would consider that the greatest honor that could come to my family. That's the type of family Corey Ten Boom came from and that they had. So now they're being invaded again by the soldiers, and they seized Corey by the elbow and took her out. And he's saying, where are the Jews? They're saying, there aren't any Jews. And the soldiers struck her across the face. Now at this time, Corey still had the flu. She's still having the flu. She can't seem to get over this flu. Where is the secret room? She says she tasted blood. And she said, Lord Jesus, protect me. And the captain said, stop that. I do not want to hear any more of that. So they were already becoming where that people did not want them to talk about the Lord and about Jesus. The whole family then were arrested. Four of her father's children, one grandchild, and her sisters. Her sisters, Betsy, her sister, Nolly, her brother, William, herself, and her father. Her mother was already dead by that time. She had died of cancer. They were put on a bus. And I think it says here, one place it says, no, not there, okay. And the bus stopped in front of a new functional building. Word was whispered back that this was Gestapo headquarters for all of Holland. And they were marched into it. They were sent in to lie on narrow beds, and she started coughing, and the straw smelled very sour, and the pallets were very hard and nasty. I would have run away back then. And then the matron came. But before that, they were marched away. She came in touch with a nurse. Any more nurses here? Pat us on the back, okay? Because we like to do good. And she said, can I do anything for you? And Corey says, yes, you can get me a Bible. You can get me a toothbrush, a needle and thread, and some soap. But the Bible was the most important. And the nurse said, I will try, but I don't make any promises. So as they were walking down and getting ready to go down this long hall to their cells, she felt something in her hand. In the waiting room, the soldier was on his feet, ready for me. As I crossed the room, the nurse rose briskly from her desk and swished past me. In my hand, I felt a small, knobby something wrapped in paper. I slid it into my coat pocket as I followed the soldier down the stairs. The other woman was already back in the car. The sick man did not reappear. All during the return ride, my hand kept straying to the object in my pocket, stroking it, tracing the outline. Oh, Lord, it's so small, but still it could be. Let it be a Bible. This Bible is going to play a very important part during their incarceration. The cell was identical to the one that they just left, six steps long, two wide, a single cot at the back. But this one was empty. As the guard's footsteps died away down the corridor, I leaned against the cold metal of the door, alone behind these walls. Now, imagine how Corey felt. Remember how we talked about how many people were in her family, how many people were in that house? She'd never been alone in her life. And here she was, alone in this cell. The wind was bitter, but she had to sit in her cell wrapped in a tight coat. In the morning, her fever was gone. I'm sorry, I misread it. In the morning, my fever was worse. I could not stand even long enough to get my food from the shelf in the door. And after an hour or so, the plate was taken away untouched. Toward evening, the pass-through dropped open again, and the hunk of coarse prison bread appeared. By now, I was desperate for food, but less able to walk than ever. Whoever was in the hall must have seen the problem. A hand picked up the bread and hurled it toward me. It landed on the floor beside the cot, where I clawed for it and gnawed it greedily. For several days, while the fever raged, my supper was delivered in this manner. Mornings, the door squealed open, and a woman in a blue smock carried the plate of hot gruel to the cot. I was as starved for the sight of a human face as for the food, and tried in a hoarse croak to start a conversation. But the woman, obviously a fellow prisoner, would only shake her head with a fearful glance toward the door. So we go on down, and she says, I felt sure that the fever had not gone, but there was nothing for me to do but to creep, trembling, to the door for my plate. When I had replaced the plate, I would lie down again on the smelly straw, steeling myself for the bawling out I knew that would come later. Look at the great lady back in bed again. Are you going to lie around there all day? Why, lying down was such a crime I never could understand. Nor indeed what one was supposed to accomplish if one got up. As my health returned, I was able to use my eyes longer. I had been sustaining myself from my scriptures, a verse at a time. Now, like a starving man, I gulped entire gospels at a reading, seeing whole the magnificent drama of salvation. And as I did, an incredible thought prickled the back of my neck. Was it possible that this, all of this that seemed so wasteful and so needless, this war, this prison, this very cell, none of it was for unforeseen or accidental? Could it be part of the pattern first revealed in the Gospels? Had Jesus, and here my reading became intent indeed, hadn't Jesus been defeated as utterly and unarguably as our little group and our small plans had been? Corrie ten Boom was arrested on February the 28th, 1944. Her birthday was April the 15th, 1944, and she was in prison. 2 days after her birthday, and that was 2 months after she was arrested, I was taken for the first time to the big, echoing shower room. Now, can you imagine going 2 months without a bath or a shower? I think sometimes we're spoiled, huh? But I'm glad we are. Nothing could dim the wonder of stepping in that wide corridor after so many weeks of close confinement, and she was marched down to the shower room, and there she had a nice long shower. And I was not long, much longer, I was not alone, I think it meant, much longer. In my solitary cell came a small, busy, black ant. What do we do with ants? I had almost put my foot where he was one morning as I carried my bucket to the door, when I realized the honor being done me. I crouched down and admired the marvelous design of legs and body. I apologized for my size and promised I would not so thoughtlessly stride about again. To have an ant as a cellmate and to be glad to have that ant, that just blows my mind. Now, and after a while, he disappeared. Now, in addition to the daily visit of the sun, I had the company of this brave and handsome guest. In fact, soon, of a whole small committee. So all the ants came by. Let's see. Now we're going to go along. She's still in prison, and she is communicating somehow with some of the other prisoners. And it says that, as far as she can tell, she and her sister Betsy are the only ones that have not been released. It was perhaps a week later that my cell door opened and a prison trustee tossed a package wrapped in brown paper onto the floor. I picked it up, hefted it, and turned it over and over. The wrapping paper had been torn open and carelessly retied. But even through the disarray, I could spot Nolly's loving touch. That's her sister, remember. And she had been captured. She had been put in prison also at the same time, but she had been released. I sat on the cot and opened it. Now, they had, I didn't tell you this before, so I'll tell you this. They had a sweater that they really loved. And Nolly had this sweater, and when she was captured, she had this sweater on. And there, familiar and welcoming as a visit from home, was the light blue embroidered sweater. Nolly had sent this sweater to her. And can you, in a drab cell where she was, the color made a big difference. Also inside the package were cookies and vitamins, needle and thread, and a bright red towel. So she took the paper, the red paper, and put it over the light bulb and made her cell bright and cheerful. She made curtains out of the towel, the red towel. Some of it she took the towel and took strings off the towel and embroidered more pictures or scenes on things. So she kept herself busy. Let's see. Let me go on to some more. After 3 months in prison, I had been called for my first hearing. Whoever used the fourth of the huts had planted a row of tulips along the side. Now they're going to a different place now. Okay, so picture this. She's going and they're going to put her in a different place, and she sees this hut and they have tulips, even though they're dead, they're wilted, but the sight of a tulip, even a dead tulip. Dear Lord, please let me go to hut number 4. That was her prayer. So, guess what? She went to hut number 4. And the officer that was in there said, he was talking to her, he says, "I hope we don't have any more days this spring as cold as this one." He drew out a chair for me to sit on. Now, she hadn't sat on a chair in a long time. Warily, I accepted it. How strange, after 3 months, to feel a chair back behind me and arms under my chairs of the arms under my arms. And the heat of the stove, she's been cold all this time, was quickly warming the little room. And she began to relax. And the captain starts talking to her about the bulbs, the tula, the yellowed bulbs. We talked about flowers for a while, and then he said, I would like to help you, Miss Tin Boon, but you must tell me everything. I may be able to do something, but only if you do not hide anything from me. For an hour, he questioned her, using every psychological trick that the young man of our group had drilled into me. In fact, I felt like a student who has crammed for a difficult exam and then is tested on only the most elementary material. It soon became clear that they believed the BG had been a headquarters for raids on food ration offices around the country. Of all the illegal activities I had on my conscience, this was probably the one I knew less about. Other than receiving the stolen cards each month and passing them on, I knew no details of the operation. Apparently, my real ignorance began to show. After a little while, the lieutenant stopped making notes of my hopelessly stupid answers. Your other activities, Miss Tin Boon, would you like to tell me about them? I love this. Other activities? Oh, you mean you want to know about my church for mentally retarded children or people? And I plunged into an eager account of my efforts at preaching to the feeble-minded. She turned the tails on him, didn't she? He wasn't going to get anything out of her. The lieutenant's eyebrows rose higher and higher. What a waste of time and energy, he exploded at last. If you want converts, surely one normal person is worth all the half-wits in the world. I stared into the man's intelligent blue eyes. True National Socialist philosophy, I thought. Tulip bed or no. And then to my astonishment, I heard my own voice saying boldly, May I tell you the truth, Lieutenant? This hearing, Miss Tintin, is predicted on the assumption that you will do me that honor. The truth, sir, I said, swallowing, is that God's viewpoint is sometime different from ours. She didn't back down. Not at all. Here she was in these horrible circumstances, and she didn't back down. So different that we could not even guess at it unless he had given us a book that tells us such a thing. She knew it was madness to talk this way to this Nazi officer, but she just plunged on. In the Bible, I learned that God values us not for our strength or our brains, but simply because he has made us. And she goes on. That'll be all for today, the lieutenant said. He didn't want to hear any more. I guess she was really getting his goat. And then one day, he came to question her, and they decided to stay outside. She liked that because she hadn't been outside very long. And I'm going to keep on going. And he tells her one day that he's in a prison even worse than what she's in. And he says, what kind of God would let this happen? Some knowledge, she goes back to what her father said, and she tells this to the lieutenant. Some knowledge is too heavy. You cannot bear it. Your father has to bear it. I'm just sort of going over this. So now they're having to stand at attention. They have to stand, when they have roll call, they all have to go out in the cold and they have to all stand in a straight line at attention. If anybody is just one tiny, tiny bit late, they all suffer. They have to all stand at a longer period. They don't have adequate clothes. They don't have adequate food. They don't have anything really that they need. So, but this one matron comes along and she changes a few things. She gives them clean sheets, a shower twice a week, and life is a little bit better for them. But then they get the order. Get your things together. Get ready to evacuate. They climbed into the train. There were 80 women in one cattle car. They had to sit like they were extortionists. No, not extortionists. What's the word? Contortionist. Contortionist. They had to wrap their legs around each other so that they would have room to sit. They stopped in the middle of the woods. The march lasted a mile or more, and Betsy was really having a hard time with this. Corrie ten Boom supported her as much as she could. This was a Dutch prison. I cannot pronounce this one either. V-U-G-H-T, what? That's good enough, right? Does that sound right? Okay, that was the prison they were going to at this time. They were in that prison. They were asked, Corrie was asked to, or with some other ladies, was asked to make some electronic things. The guy that was over them was a different type of person. Even though he was a trustee and all, he would at night come along and pull the wires off from what they were doing. And I thought it was, let me see if this. He found out that Corrie was a watchmaker, so he sent her to the watchmaker place. He came over once and he said, "Do you know who you're making these watches for?" She hadn't thought of that, because Corrie, you know, is an honest person and all. He said, "We do not want to further the cause for the German people." He said, "Slow down. You're going too fast. Doing things correctly too fast." And that was a surprise for her. In fact, he says, "Dear watch lady, can you remember for whom you are working? These radios are for their fighter planes." And reaching across me, he would yank a wire from its housing or twist a tiny tube from the assembly. So he was on their side, even though he couldn't let his superiors know that. The days in Vought were a baffling mixture of good and bad. The morning call was terrible, but Betsy, especially, was teaching the women about God and about Jesus. And everywhere that Betsy went, Betsy was a great, great person for teaching and having a positive attitude. At 6 a.m. one day, they were ordered to collect their personal things. All they had was a pillowcase, so they put them in there. And so they were taken to another place. I'm going on because our time's running. Have any of you ever seen Schindler's List? Do you remember in there where it showed that the ladies had cut their hair? Well, when Betsy and Corrie ten Boom went to this one place, they went into this, they noticed that the ladies were cutting their hair, and they couldn't figure out why. And so they went into this barracks that they were assigned, and they had to climb over other ladies to get to the bed that they were assigned. And all of a sudden, they started itching, and these things, they had fleas. The barracks was covered in fleas. And so, of course, they decided to cut their hair too. And one of the things that Corrie said they had to do, now remember, Betsy and Corrie had never been married. They were not in the habit of going naked in front of anybody, much less men. But they had to take off their clothes, and they showed this in Schindler's List. And they had to parade down a line. This was called their medical exam in front of all these guards without a stitch of clothes on. Parade down there and then back. And they had to do that quite often. That was extremely embarrassing for them. And Corey and Betsy said, why in the world would God send these fleas? What are fleas? You know, what good are fleas? That's the way I think about fire ants. What are good are fleas? But later on, they found out why God sent the fleas. Because the overseers would not come into the barracks, their barracks. So they had sort of more freedom than the other barracks. And the overseers would not come into the barracks because of the fleas. So God blessed them with fleas. Can you imagine with fleas? Now, Corey, since we're running out of time, I'm not going to go over things. But I hope that you will read this, and I hope that you will see that Corey Ten Boom was a wonderful, wonderful ambassador for God and for Jesus. She went around teaching till the day she died. She wrote many books. There's one that I love called The Tramp, T-R-A-M-P, for God. She taught and wrote books, even did some movies until the day she died. She always had tremendous faith that God would take care of her. Sometimes she had money wherever she went, sometimes she didn't, but God always provided. And this, to me, says what Corrie Ten Boom was. You are God's own masterpiece. That means you are not ordinary or average. You are a one of a kind, an original. When God created you, he went to great lengths to make you exactly the way he wanted you to be. He gave you the right personality, the right gifts, the right talents, and the right connections to do exactly what he's called you to do. The question is, do you recognize the treasure you possess? Corey and Betsy did. Today, don't settle for living an ordinary life. Unlock the hidden treasures inside of you. Each morning when you get out of bed, remind yourself, I am a masterpiece. I am handpicked by God. And I am a person of extreme value and significance. Remember, you are an original. You're not meant to be like anyone else. God designed you the way you are for a specific purpose. Everything about you is unique, and every detail about you matters. You are his most prized treasure. And thank you for being here.